Welcome to The Connection, where humans and aliens converse, and where all the dots are connected. I'm Nancy of Zeta Talk, an emissary for aliens from Zeta Reticuli. They are here to warn of great cataclysms on Earth and advise how to survive this. The pending pole shift is not the end. Man will make his next leap forward to live a better time when aliens will live among us. A natural offshoot of the Zeta Talk website were discussions on how to survive the pole shift that had been predicted by the Zetas. This evolved into the Trouble Times website and discussion groups. They had as their mission to brainstorm survival solutions and solutions for life in the aftertime and post these on the web for the world to access. Hundreds of people offered solutions which were aggressively discussed. So the process was not simply a matter of posting theories or ideas, but posting suggestions that had gone through the gauntlet, been challenged, supported, and survived, in essence, a grueling exam. Trouble Times divided solutions into categories, each of which have dozens of topics, each of which have dozens of individual postings. The primary categories are food, shelter, energy, and health. A nonprofit was formed to help get the word out and has published a booklet based on the gist of this mass of information. This booklet is available for $5, including postage, which is below cost. Later, a twin set CD, one of which can be read and browsed by an Adobe Reader and another in web format, were also made available at or below cost. $4.10 for the twin set, and this includes postage. Well, a combo package is available for $7.50, and that takes advantage of a single posting. There's a link to where to order these items from the blog homepage, as well as the Zeta Talk homepage. But all of this is available on the web. You can also download that booklet as a PDF and print it off yourself at home. And you can also webwhack the Trouble Times pages, although I think that's kind of an undertaking because of the many links, almost 1,000 links to external websites that are made within Trouble Times. The cover of the booklet expresses the philosophy of Trouble Times well, and the nonprofit which has made this material available in booklet and CD format for the public, and I quote, "This booklet presents issues which a family or individual would be presented with in the event of a global catastrophe such as a pole shift. This booklet is not intended to be a survival guide, but a guide to information sources, an overview of problems, possible solutions, and options available. After such a catastrophe, there would be a loss of government and utility services such as power and clean water, volcanic gloom with dust polluting the ground and well water, and a lack of fresh food. But healthy living through and after such a catastrophe is possible. Mankind has lived through these before. A family or individual can be helped to keep a cool head during troubled times if armed with knowledge of the steps they can take to better their chances. Panic should be avoided, particularly when young children are involved, and serves no good purpose. With knowledge, a family or individual can be empowered with a sense of control over their circumstances. Each family or individual must think for themselves, and only they know of their special circumstances, matters particular to their environment, and their ability to prepare. Some families or individuals will find themselves on foot with no or few belongings. Others will find themselves with a safe place to go, which can be stocked with supplies, but even these settlements can find themselves overtaken and robbed." End of the quote from the Trouble Times booklet cover. Basic survival assumes surviving the pole shift itself, which involves avoiding coastlines, floodplains, mountain building or volcanic areas, and structures which can fall upon and crush one. Zeta Talk has advised being in a shallow trench covered by a well-secured tin roof or sod-covered board so that winds carrying debris will just pass over. Worst case, a survivor will find themselves completely unprepared or with scant notice of what is coming. Given a last-minute notice, what are the items of prime importance? Well, Homeland Security advises a 3-day supply of food and water, a flashlight, and other family items that might be needed in the short term. Bad advice for living through and past a pole shift and utterly short-sighted. In fact, Homeland Security advice would not even get one past the days leading up to the pole shift, when travel and shopping will be virtually impossible. And certainly, Homeland Security is not addressing life after a global catastrophe, inferring that rescue after 3 days would occur when there will be no rescue. I quote from Zeta Talk, Last Minute Panic. In spite of denial and suppression of talk about the approaching cataclysms, when the Earth slows and then stops in its rotation, the truth will be known. Those who have prepared and placed themselves and their loved ones in safe places will not find themselves overrun at the last minute. This is not because last-minute stragglers are not trying to join them. This is because the stragglers cannot reach them. Imagine the situation. On one side of the earth, the sun is not setting. Temperatures rise. Machines break down. The telephone lines are jammed and highways blocked with disabled cars. Those on foot don't last long in the heat. Essentially, it's all heat-locked. People will seek a cool spot and wait for whatever comes. On the other side of the earth, perpetual night is reigning. Here, activity is not heat-locked, but is rather sleep-locked. Businesses do not open as everyone is confused. Are the clocks broken? Telephone lines are also jammed and lack of coordination is evident everywhere. The night shift goes home, eventually, exhausted, but the day shift never shows up. The traveler attempting to drive somewhere finds gas stations unattended and cars out of gas blocking the roads. So those becoming aware of the situation at the last minute do not go anywhere, essentially, whether they want to or not. End of the quote from Last Minute Panic, written on August 15, 1995. Well, what do Trouble Times teams recommend that you gather for an emergency pole shift survival backpack? Here's some items. A small shovel for digging a trench, preferably one of those military-type shovels. An axe to cut and split wood. A wok for boiling and cooking food and to act as a serving dish. A meat cleaver, which can also be used to create tinder slivers from wood when attempting to start fires. Pliers, vice grips, and heavy-duty metal shears for rescue and shelter building. Spools of wire and brass to avoid rusting, to make traps to snare small game, and fish hooks. Some kind of water distillation rig. A book on edible wild plants. A first aid kit. And matches or a fire-starting flint. These are not items that one might throw in a backpack if thinking of bugging out and rushing into the hills in an emergency. I mean, today, people would say, oh, candy bars, change of underwear, flashlight, maybe a book to read. But in the long term, rather than the very short term, these are items that should be considered. Those with only such a backpack cobbled together at the last minute might be assumed to be on foot and walking a lot, and one of the prime things that the Trouble Times teams have advised is to pay particular attention to your feet. Keep your feet dry. Change your socks often. Eatings. The immediate needs of those on foot will be something to eat and clean water to drink. In this regard, eating bugs and weeds and distilling your drinking water are recommended. Be prepared to eat bugs. those that fly, crawl, and in particular grubs, which can be found in rotting wood. Now, you know, it's all part of our evolutionary past, unnatural. And I quote from Zeta Talk, vegetarian. Humans are designed, due to the influence of food availability during evolution, to eat either vegetables and fruits or meat, but not at the same time. This is a fact not widely recognized or understood by humans, and thus they do themselves damage by eating both foods at meals routinely. Imagine the caveman on the road, traveling to lush fields of vegetation where fruits and grains and tubers could be located with ease. The troop kills a deer or an elephant and feasts on nothing but meat and blood for days, consuming the entire kill before it can spoil. They do this repeatedly while on the road. When they arrive at their destination, they find they no longer need to take the physical risks that hunting invariably presents, flailing hooves and charging frightened beasts. They become vegetarians. Modern man misunderstood what the caveman ate while lolling about during their vegetarian periods. They did not live strictly on vegetables and fruits and grains. They ate any and everything that was handy, and this included numerous insects and slow-moving life forms such as mollusks or opossums. They ate less meat, but the diet was highly varied and included occasional small bits from sources other than plants. Thus, those modern humans who try to live what they interpret to be a strictly vegetarian life suffer from malnutrition, poor immunity, anemia, lack of strength, and inability to deal with stress. Man was not designed to live by vegetables alone and must accommodate their body with protein sources from living creatures other than plants, or suffer the consequences. End of the quote from Zeta Talk, Vegetarian, written on July 15, 1997. Eating bugs is a much overlooked source of protein and fat, and many recipes exist. Think of it. Bears eat grubs, and look how big and fat they are. And I quote from Insects as Human Food from Ohio State Fact Sheet on Entomology. The eating of insects has yet to become a day-to-day activity for most people in the United States and Europe, in spite of the superior nutritional content of edible insects compared to other animals. Other cultures around the world have made insects a main ingredient in their diets, providing an excellent source of protein. Insects are an inexpensive substitute for meat in many developing countries. In Mexico, grasshoppers and other edible insects are sold by the pound in village markets and are fried before being eaten. Many are sold in cans as fried grasshoppers, chocolate-covered ants, etc. Tortillas are covered with red and white agave worms in many Mexican city restaurants. Colombian citizens enjoy eating a variety of insects such as termites, palm grubs, and ants. Ants are ground up and used as a spread on breads. Popular insects eaten in the Philippines are June beetles, grasshoppers, ants, mole crickets, water beetles, katydids, locusts, and dragonfly larvae. They can be fried, broiled, or sautéed with vegetables. In parts of Africa, ants, termites, beetle grubs, caterpillars, and grasshoppers are eaten. Some insects, such as termites, are eaten raw soon after catching, while others are baked or fried before eating. The giant water bug, roasted and eaten whole, is a favorite food in Asia. It's easily collected around lights at night around bodies of water. Sago grubs are popular for cooks in Papua New Guinea, most often boiled or roasted over an open fire. Other edible insects eaten in this country include larvae of moths, wasps, butterflies, dragonflies, beetles, adult grasshoppers, cicadas, stick insects, moths, and crickets. End of the quote from Insects as Human Food from Ohio State Fact Sheet on Entomology. Eating weeds. I was surprised to find that many of the weeds I was pulling out of my garden were not only edible, but delicious. Pigweed, also known by many other names, was sweet and far tastier than lettuce. Lamb's quarters, dandelion, and plantain are also completely edible, and plantain is sky-high in vitamin A. I quote from the Troubled Times booklet. Kudzu produces edible roots. The ripe pollen from cattails can be used as a flour substitute. Lichen are edible. Puffballs are great when fried. Burdock roots can be harvested out of wet marshlands and are like potatoes. Chickweed can be used raw as a salad green, as can any weed in the mustard family. The leaves of violets can be used as a green salad or cooked and eaten like spinach. End of the quote. Highly recommended are books on wild edibles in your locale. Get your hands on these books while you can. Plugging the word wild and edible and weeds into any search engine should bring them up. Hunting and fishing. Hunting will only go so far, as if all are hunting, wildlife will soon disappear. But for those areas supporting hunting, the options are to have guns, which will run out of bullets soon enough, or more primitive and time-honored methods, such as slingshots or bow and arrow or crossbow or traps. Fishing methods are also tried and true and time-honored, and include trawling, where a net or basket is dragged along the bottom for crawfish or crabs, bait on a line, bait in traps, or casting nets. I quote from the Troubled Times pages. In Australia, we don't use bait when fishing for freshwater crayfish. We trawl for them. To make a basket to trawl for them, you just need to shape chicken wire into an open basket and strengthen the top with heavy-duty fencing wire in a rectangular shape. Well, this is to stop it from collapsing while dragging it. Attach two ropes to the corners, like crossover handles, then attach a long rope to the center of these handles and it's finished. Throw the basket out into the pond and wait a while, then start pulling the basket slowly over the bottom towards you. The basket picks up the crayfish out of the mud. End of the quote. There are books on how to construct bow and arrows, crossbow and such. One recommended is The Traditional Bower's Bible by Jim Ham. Get your hands on these books while you still can. Drinking. Distilling drinking water not only gets rid of germs due to the boiling process, but also heavy metals such as mercury and lead, and pollutants such as gasoline that may be in the ground or well water. Water distillation can be a simple matter, as described in the Troubled Times booklet, and I quote, "You can distill water with an ordinary household pot with two pot lids. Boil water in a pot covered with the first pot lid, and when water condenses on this pot lid, it is distilled water. Replace that first pot lid with the second one and flip the first one over quickly, bottom up, so that all the condensed water collects in the lid. Then pour this into a cup. Just keep repeating those steps until you have a full cup of drinking water." End of quote. A second easy and portable distillation method is to have stacked pots, the upper pot holding cold water, which forces condensation on its bottom while the bottom pot boils. In between the pots, put a pie pan with a drain hole and a tube to catch the distillate. This method produces a gallon of distilled water every 2.5 hours, and in the end, you've got a pot of hot water up top for washing. And I quote from Zeta Talk, "Safe Water." After the cataclysms, mankind's problem with his water supply will take a quantum leap. Water from all sources may be poisoned, with the old standby rainwater failing to provide potable water. During the pole shift, volcanoes, old and new, will violently erupt. The resulting ash will sift down from the upper atmosphere for decades, poisoning groundwater. Humans driven to drink this gritty water will find more than grit between their teeth. They will find their nervous system beginning to fail them, their eyesight fading, and their digestive system intolerant of any food they may find. We are speaking here primarily of lead poisoning, which is not a problem man expects from their drinking water that nature provides. Lead settles and over time settles down out of the way, but after a cataclysm, the lead mantle has been spewed out over the landscape, most of this vomit in the form of fine billowing dust. Will the groundwater not be safe? Well, depends. During the cataclysms, the ground is heaved and jerked, and any wells or piping will be shattered. In that the groundwater is as likely to carry poisons as the surface, having filtered down from the surface, what looks like pure water from underground may be, again, a slow death. Groundwater is also subject to contact with lead-heavy mantle, which most often does not make it all the way to the surface during eruptions. If one cannot trust the usual water supply, what to do? Distillation process or recycling water known to be pure are two approaches likely to provide a steady supply of water. This may seem tedious to those so used to taking fresh, pure water for granted, but those who prepare for the times ahead will not find themselves suddenly without one of life's necessities. End of the quote from Zeta Talk, Safe Water, written August 15, 1995. Lead poisoning can be counteracted by eating a diet high in iron and other minerals, a process called a chelation. Should you find yourself or your loved ones suffering nerve damage from lead poisoning, from drinking that groundwater polluted with volcanic ash, vitamin C is also an important part of this process. Mineral-heavy diet, vitamin-heavy diet. Vitamin C is available in more than orange juice. Scurvy grass, the tips of pine needles, sorrel, which is a weed, and many garden vegetables such as peppers and cabbage are sky high in vitamin C. Eat raw so as not to destroy that vitamin C with heat. Toilet paper. Hygiene, such as handy toilet paper, soap, toothbrush and paste, and disposable diapers, these are all things modern man has come to take for granted. Well, what did the caveman use? Or what do today's hunting and gathering tribes use? There's a number of options for toilet paper, including sand, ashes, leaves, or moss. And my favorite, backing up to a pine branch such that it swifts backwards as you stand up. Moss also makes a good diaper filler, if washing diapers is not convenient, and this applies to menstrual periods also. Well, a toothbrush can be fashioned from a furred end of a branch, and rinsing with salt and water can kill germs. Shelter. Assuming you didn't have time to grab a tent, creating shelters while on foot is still possible. These can range from sleeping under a tarp, creating a tent from saplings and branches, or finding a rock overhang or cave. I quote from the Trouble Times pages. Another good Indian trick for temporary shelter is to find a cluster of saplings and bend them over and tie them to each other without cutting them down. Well, they're already anchored down, and after being bent, can be thatched, etc., to provide reasonable cover. When you leave, just remove the rope you used to tie them, and everything is restored to its original natural state. End of the quote. Injury. Addressing medical emergencies in the absence of a doctor or dentist can be very scary, but there are many books out on these matters. Some are put out by the U.S. Army or the armed services of other countries and are readily available. Here's some examples. Where There Is No Doctor by the Hesperian Foundation. Where There Is No Dentist, also by the Hesperian Foundation. Special Forces Medical Handbook by the U.S. Army. Ditch Medicine, Advanced Field Procedures for Emergencies by Coffee. Emergency War Surgery by Bowen. War Surgery? Many survivors of the pole shift will feel that term applies. Maggots can also be used to eat dead flesh that will create sepsis if not removed, and can be found where flies have laid their eggs. Leeches are also used to help improve circulation in injured extremities. They pull the blood out at that far end so that fresh blood can flow down into the extremity. Just remove the leeches or maggots when the job is done. I quote from the Troubled Times pages. "Doctor, there's a maggot in my wound." From the BBC Online, March 6, 1999. Maggots can help to clean ulcers and other wounds. Maggots have had a bad press. Normally associated with disease and rotting flesh, doctors now realize they can treat infections. The squirming larvae were first found to have curative properties during World War I. Maggots were getting into the wounds of people injured on the battlefield. Well, instead of making the wound worse, they helped clear it up. With the advent of antibiotics in the 1940s, the therapy went out of fashion. However, they are now making a comeback because of concerns about infections that are resistant to antibiotic treatment. Maggots clean wounds by eating dead tissue. They first spit out enzymes that liquefy the tissue and then suck it up like soup. They are put on the surface of the wound and then sealed in with a bandage. The maggots only feed on the dead tissue. During the course of a 3-day treatment, the maggots' bodies, full of dead tissue, expand from an average length of 2 millimeters to 3 times the size. They leave wounds pink and healthy. End of the quote. Gardens. Well, congratulations. You've survived your first few days after the pole shift. You've either died of your injuries or healed, starved to death, or managed to diet by what nature provides. And as a survivor, you've lost that fat and are lean and taut, in shape, and due to eating many foods raw, are probably feeling better than you can remember. Now you're ready to start thinking about forming or joining a community. Or perhaps you've had time to plan ahead of time, and you're already in that setting. Settlements bring the advantage of gardens. For settlement gardens, the requirements are primarily seed and secondarily gardening tools. If you don't have viable seed, you're going to be stuck eating those weeds for a long, long time. Just as important as securing the seeds in the first place is knowing how to save them, as this is a recurring necessity. For some plants, such as beans or corn or grains, this is ultra simple. Simply let dry on the plant and gather. For other plants, the seed requires fermentation or it will not germinate. This is the case for tomatoes, where the seeds need to be placed in vats and allowed to cover over with white mold, stirred for several days like this, and then rinsed and dried. The reason for this fermentation process is that the seed assumes it's still in the tomato otherwise, covered by a slime. And until this slime molders off, it continues to assume it's still in the tomato. In a natural state, the tomato falls to the ground, splits open, and molders there. And I quote from the Troubled Times website, Mother Earth News, September-October 1978, Harvesting. As in just about every other aspect of seed production, harvesting procedures vary from one vegetable to the next. Beans, peas, and other legumes let the finest pods on the most vigorous plants remain on the vine until they're completely dry. At that time, they should be brown or yellow, depending on the variety, and the seeds should rattle. Then just pick and shell. Pulpy fruits and vegetables, such as tomatoes, squash, cucumbers, melons, peppers, eggplant, and okra. Pick the fruit when it is dead ripe. Scoop out the seed-bearing pulp and place in a container with enough water to cover. Next, allow the mixture to sit and ferment at room temperature for 5 to 7 days. By then, the seeds should have been separated from the pulp and fallen to the bottom of the container. After rinsing the seeds until they are clean, spread them out in a cool place to dry. Corn, such as sweet corn, field corn, popcorn, The ears should remain on the stalks until the kernels are hard and dry, about 3 to 5 weeks after the eating stage. Shell the ears only when the kernels have completely dried. End of the quote from Mother Earth News on harvesting. Many plants, such as cabbage, will put up a stalk with delicate pods that shatter easily and toss the tiny seeds about. Mother Earth suggests, and I quote, mustard family crops, such as cabbage, kale, collards, cauliflower, kohlrabi, broccoli, Brussels sprouts, mustard, radishes, rutabagas, and turnips. Cut the seed stalks before their pods have completely dried out, then hang them indoors for 2 to 3 weeks to finish curing. End of the quote. Well, in my experience, be prepared to find these tiny seeds on the floor, so have a tray under the pods just in case, because when they're very dry, they shatter with a touch. All seeds from fruits, such as tomatoes or peppers or melons or squash, are best if from very fully ripe fruits. For instance, a green pepper will have immature seeds. So let that pepper ripen until it's fragrant and red-colored or just about ready to fall apart into the rotting stage. And I quote from Organic Gardening, September-October 1992. Peppers are the easiest. The seeds are mature after the peppers have changed color to their final stage. Cut the peppers open, scrape the seeds into a plate, and stir twice daily to ensure even drying and to keep them from clumping together. End of the quote. Other seeds, like lettuce, will fly away like dandelion heads if not harvested almost daily. Amaranth drops seeds readily, so the seed head should be put in a paper bag and shaken periodically, daily. But most seeds can be located and harvested and dried readily. Spinach seeds stick to the stalk. They don't fall off into the mud. Pumpkin can easily be scooped out and washed and dried. And some seeds need a resting period before they will germinate, nature's way of ensuring that they not confront the winter as young sprouts, but wait until the spring before sprouting. Store seeds in a very dry, cool place, capped or tightly sealed in a jar or a Ziploc bag, as moisture can ruin them. Seed lasts for years. Some seed, like onion, well, lasting only a year or so, but others for an amazingly long time. I think I read something where a 2,000-year-old seed germinated. In general, the percentage of seed that will germinate reduces steadily year after year. I recently did a germination test on some non-hybrid meal corn, harvested 5 years ago, and found the germination well over 95%. I highly advise everyone to get their hands on Susan Ashworth's book, Seed to Seed, and practice the art of seed gathering, starting now. Well, you're a city dweller, and you protest you have no opportunity. Well, you're not noticing what you're trashing. Are you eating acorn squash, melons, and peppers, and trashing the seeds? Are you eating tomatoes and eating the seeds? Ripen that pepper in a windowsill alongside a bowl of moldering tomato seeds and scrape out and clean those squash and melon seeds. Don't toss that bunch of Indian corn used as a decoration at fall, but shuck it and save the seed. You'll be gathering the seeds you need for your future garden right now. A note on beekeeping and the need for pollinators. Many, many bugs pollinate plants. I've personally seen wasps and bumblebees and beetles and ants crawling all over flowers in my garden, and they were more numerous than the wild honeybees. Also, some staples like tomatoes and beans are self-pollinating, requiring only the gentle wind to make it happen. And other plants like corn are wind-pollinated. So don't panic if you don't have a beehive nearby. Flocks and herds. Chickens, ducks, rabbits, and goats eat almost anything. If you're tired of eating bugs while on foot, you'll find switching to chickens and eggs a delight as they eat the bugs instead. Chickens and ducks just love bugs. Chickens free-range, scratch along the ground for worms, and Ducks turn themselves upside down, nibbling on what grows along the bottoms of ponds. Both eat vegetables. Melon rinds or carrot tops, things we pampered humans think of as garbage. It's a treat for your flocks. Rabbits can be added to the stew pot and reproduce with alacrity. They eat grass or any other vegetation handy and are easy to keep in pens. Well, they're quiet, too. Goats are so omnivorous they are known to eat poison ivy, and as herds they have the advantage of bonding with their herdsmen. They will follow their herdsmen anywhere. Goat milk and goat cheese are second to none, superior to cow's milk and cheese in many respects. And, of course, keeping sheep will provide mutton and wool. Tap water. Settlements may form where farmsteads used to be, with the possibility of a well handy, or one can be put in at a likely spot. I quote from the Troubled Times pages. I grew up on a farm. For years, my family used manual pumps. I remember watching uncles and community members take turns pounding metal pipes with sledgehammers, threading the pipe manually with a small vise-held threader, and connecting the 10-foot lengths of pipe by hand. There was a strainer attached to the first segment at the bottom that kept the pipe free of most debris, and when water was reached, the water would gush out, mud, sand, and small rocks that might have been trapped in the pipe. I remember the water shooting off like a small oil well. The family would just let it flow until the sand stopped coming up. I remember once the sand did not stop and the well digging had to continue 20 or 30 more feet. When water finally was reached, usually at about 65 to 100 feet, a manual pump was installed and primed. We as children got a kick out of pumping the water. The only small problem that I remember was that you had to keep a small amount of water present at all times to prime the pump. End of the quote. Well, hand pumps are inexpensive to buy and should be one of the first items purchased by anyone seriously thinking about survival communities. They range from small sink-side pumps to perhaps $50 to more robust pumps that can run $1,000 or so. Get the brass fittings to avoid corrosion. Hand pumps seal the edges of the working parts with something called leathers, which are just that, leather. And these little circles periodically need to be replaced, but this is an item a community could fashion for themselves. All parts of a hand pump assembly, including the pipe sections long enough to reach the water down at the bottom of the well, should be in hand and on site prior to the shift. As with electrical networks, the missing parts can prove to be a showstopper. Electricity. 12-volt electricity is the way to go, as it can use your car batteries and headlights, and camping and boating lighting systems are 12-volt. 12-volt systems also require less juice, they're direct current, so any windmill or water wheel system used to establish electricity will go further. In a pinch, one can use the rear wheel of a bike gen rig combined with an alternator to recharge those batteries. All this is on the Troubled Times website and can be researched by someone familiar and knowledgeable with electric requirements. Crank-up devices as a means of powering a radio or flashlight are also available. I quote from the Troubled Times pages. A crank-up radio helps Africa tune in. From the New York Times, dated February 8, 1996. For about 6 weeks now, a small factory in Millerton, South Africa, just north of Cape Town, has been cranking out radios with cranks. Give the handle a few aerobic turns and the free play radio holds forth for half an hour. It weighs 6 pounds, is built like an overstuffed lunchbox, and has a tiny speaker. But its wholesale price is only $40 and it gets AM, FM, and shortwave. End of the quote. Well, windmills and watermills take advantage of natural wind and water flows, and will be a more permanent source of electricity. All these rigs require a lot of parts and expertise and may require a battery system, so they're not a casual undertaking. Steam is also a time-honored way to generate electricity and transportation, too, as in those old-fashioned steam trains that puffed across the prairies. But be cautious with steam, as a broken pipe can create a terrible burn. As a replacement for gasoline, wood gas or biomass fuels are used today. That's what ethanol is, for instance. I quote from the Troubled Times pages a report from Ali in Finland on wood gas. My cousin got a wood gas-powered car as a gift a couple months ago. It's a Volvo 245 station wagon with a 2.1-liter engine, model 1974, modified to use wood gas sometime in the early 1990s. I personally am quite impressed with the performance, top speed 100-plus kilometer per hour. I expected much less. We have used pieces of birch wood as the fuel, and it must be dry or it won't work. With the car, we got quite good documentation of the wood gas system with drawings. Almost all non-military trucks and buses in Finland were operating with wood gas during the Second World War and even up to the early 50s. All gasoline available went to the military. I have heard that the Finnish Army used a couple of wood gas-powered trucks even in 1964. In a local magazine, there was recently an article on wood gas-equipped cars, and the story says that there are about 40 wood gas-equipped vehicles in Finland today. End of the quote. The diagrams that came with Ali's wood gas-burning car are available on the Troubled Times website, by the way, and are complete. They show the whole process. They explain what needs to be done, what parts need to be cleaned, because it does get kind of clogged with tar. And these are included, these diagrams, in the $4.10 CD twin set that include all of the Troubled Times pages. Get these CDs or go to the website and print off these diagrams and have them handy for when you might need them in the future. Remember, the electric grid will go down. Your PCs won't be working. But if you have a paper copy, and particularly if you've got that paper copy laminated so it won't get wrecked in the humidity, you've got something solid. Hand tools. Hand tools, not those items run by electricity, will be a necessity. Many hand tools, such as a cross-cut saw, are available today, for instance, from Harbor Freight for only $20, and they can be purchased. Often yard sales will produce a lot of hand tools from the past, something Grandpa used but now considered trash. They've been replaced by modern drills and saws, but these modern drills and saws will not work when the grid is down. Be sure to include plenty of nails, screws, and bolts. Jacks and pulley systems can move heavy objects, so don't forget plenty of rope and chain, too. Settlements bring the advantage of gardens and domesticated flocks and herds, but they also bring back the issue of sewage. Outhouses can be placed in fields where crops are to be grown and moved along the rows, spreading the fertilizer, as it were, or they can just be stationary close to the settlement. I quote from the Troubled Times pages on the specs for building an outhouse. You need a 4x4x5 foot deep pit. You make a reinforced 7x7 foot concrete slab with integral rings on the top and the sides so you can move it later. You build an outhouse building over it with a toilet box and a vent or ventilation slats on the sides of the building. When the pit fills up, you drag the whole structure to a new spot and cover up the old hole with the fill that you took out in the first place. End of the quote. To avoid a run to the outhouse in the middle of the night, the old-fashioned chamber pot can be used, and any covered pail will do. I speak from personal experience here, I use a pail and cover myself, as we have only one bathroom in this old house, and I don't want to have to run the stairs at night. And cleaning products. Soap making is simply cooking animal fat with lye, perhaps adding some scent. Lye is gotten from draining water through ashes, and hardwood ashes work best. The mixture is cooked down and poured into pans and cut into bars when cool. I quote from the Trouble Times pages, which relied heavily on the Foxfire book series here. Making lye water from ashes is similar to making drip coffee. Place paper or corn shucks to act as a filter along the bottom of a V or funnel-shaped container and simply pour water in the top until it drips out the bottom into a pail. The mixture, which is stirred continuously, should turn white or whitish and thicken. The mixture should be stirred while lye or water is being added. When using lye water made from ashes, the soap mixture must boil longer before the water is reduced to where the mixture will make solid rather than soft soap. Pour the mixture into a pan lined with cloth and let it sit for a couple of days. This curing is an important step, as uncured soap can contain free lye in places that will irritate the skin. The cured soap may be covered with a white powder, which should be brushed off as it likewise may irritate the skin. When hardened, the soap can be cut into bars or blocks and stored indefinitely. End of the quote. Vinegar is another cleaning product, also a food. Place an acid fruit or juice into a crockery and allow to ferment, covered by a cloth while on a dark, warm place. Then strain through that cloth to clarify. Apparently, fermenting vinegar in iron, aluminum, or plastic containers is not advised. Clothing. Needle and thread will go a long way toward repairing clothing and blankets, but eventually new clothing will have to be manufactured. Time-honored methods include making cloth from leather after tanning the skins and cloth from various fibers, such as flax, cotton, or wool. Flax stems are laid in water to rot off all but the fibers and then combed. Flax today is used to make linen. Cotton and wool are carded, placed between two brushes pulled in opposite directions to straighten those fibers. The fibers can be spun into yarn or threads by many methods, but the essential steps are to create a single thread twisted in one direction, let's say clockwise, and then to take two or three of such strands and twist them together in the opposite direction, in this case, counterclockwise. This gives great strength to the thread, which will be unlikely to unravel because of the twisting in different directions. I personally have had the advantage of learning to spin and weave when young, something my mother felt impelled to ensure that I would learn for some reason. Along with piano lessons, I had spinning wheel lessons. I've created detailed charts of the process from my memory using a spinning wheel and loom for the Trouble Times pages. This is in the clothing topic in the shelter section. For those wanting this handy, it's also included, by the way, in that $4.10 CD set of all the Trouble Times web pages and can be printed off. Spinning and weaving are still taught and practiced in many Appalachian states, and spinning wheels and looms can be purchased from many sources. Making leather involves stretching and scraping the skin to remove fat and flesh from the underside, and if desired, hair from the outer side. The hide is then smoked to allow the next step, braining, to penetrate the skin more readily. Braining? Apparently tanning is done using the brains of the animal killed, or any brain, as a mash. And I quote from the Trouble Times website, "After thoroughly fleshing, dehairing, and scraping, the hide is ready to be brained. The more thoroughly liquidated the brains are, the more efficient the tanning solution. It is also a good idea to mix them in warm water. Use just enough water to cover the hide. Pre-smoke. The smoke is like an enzyme that strips the glues from the hide, therefore allowing more efficient penetration of the brains. You then soak the hides in the brains about 15 minutes, working and wringing the hide in the solution. You then take the hide out and thoroughly wring it out using a fence rail and stick or whatever works. Wringing is very important to get good brain penetration. Soak and wring several times within an hour. It shouldn't take longer than this for a good braining. You can tell when you have good brain penetration when you can stretch the hide on any part of the hide in any direction and it stretches 2-3 inches. The brains also bleach the hide out white, and it is also at this time that any leftover epidermis will show up yellowish, and any missed hair follicles will look like pepper all over the hide. End of the quote. The hide is apparently then stretched and dried. Herbal meds. Herbal medicine is time-honored, and where debunked by the pharmaceutical companies, I can attest that they are astonishingly effective. My personal story is with comfrey leaf to cause new skin to grow. Comfrey is known as bone knit in England, and I think they got this from India, where it's known to help broken bones heal. A person's given comfrey tea, and it helps the bones to heal. I had a family member that had a cyst removed from his tailbone, a deep incision that had to heal from the inside out. Well, as a result, we had uneven skin alignment along the cut, and there was a piece of flesh about an inch square that had no skin at all on the top of it at the end of this process. After a couple of months, this spot had only progressed to be kind of a purple patch with a whitish cover, and I feared it would fill in with scar tissue and be that way forever. Well, I chopped the comfrey leaf up to make a compress and taped it there for the day. And at the end of that first day, the skin had turned light pink. Chopped up another leaf for compress, same deal. And at the end of the second day, the center part of that raw flesh area that had no skin whatsoever had raised and become a deep pink. Well, chopped up a third leaf, and at the end of that day, normal skin. I kid you not, in 3 days. I know of no pharmaceutical product that can do that. Nothing the doctor can offer to you that can do that. Comfrey apparently has an ingredient that encourages cell division. My second report is secondhand from someone who had endured whiplash and was on painkillers for headaches. Well, this went on, and the person seemed to be able to get off the painkillers, but wanted to go back to work, but the side effects were preventing that. So they tried feverfew, which is an herb I have in my garden. Didn't know what it was used for. And this feverfew tea allowed him to get rid of the painkillers and relieve the headaches. My understanding is it also made him a little grumpy. The side effect is you get irritable. My recommendation, get herb seeds. Plant them if you're in a permanent place, and get some herb books to learn how to use them, because the time may come when you're very glad you did that. Housing. Those who have had more time and opportunity to prepare will most likely be looking to rebuild homes after the shift, as the combination of earthquakes and hurricane force winds will bring down most existing housing. Some structures, such as basements or grain silos, or even trashed cars and vans, might be good temporary homes. But several existing construction techniques could be utilized. These include adobe brick homes, straw bale homes, rammed earth homes, and houseboats. These require supplies like boards and bags of cement dust and tools like hammer and nails. To show how comprehensive the brainstorming done in the early days of the Troubled Times website was, I'll give you a recipe for Portland cement. And I quote, "If limestone is heated red hot for a long enough time, it turns into chunks of lightweight white substance called quicklime. This is mixed with water, which makes a chemical reaction, as in Portland cement. I think they called this slake lime. To this bubbling white goo, they added sand for mortar, or sand and gravel for cement. To waterproof it, They liked to add volcanic ash, but since this was rarely available, they used crushed clay tiles instead. The red clay in the tiles made their mortar pink. So, when I can't buy a bag of Portland cement anymore, at least I know how to make it. End of the quote. Glue can also be made from boiling down animal protein due to the collagen in the protein. The old adage about horses' hooves going into the glue pot, I guess. After the pole shift, building materials such as wood or stone may be in short supply, and using earth to extend the available concrete may be just the thing. I quote from the Troubled Times pages an article called Terra Firma, published June 2, 1996 in the San Francisco Examiner. For all of recorded history, dirt has been the primary source of building material. As many members of our species grew up in caves, it was natural that humans would fashion earth into walls, as they did in the Kaaba of Morocco, in the Great Walls of China, in the Alhambra in Spain, and in the ancient Anasazi pueblos in what would become the American Southwest. Earthen walls, poured and compacted into wooden frames, can last a millennium. In some rural region of France, 90% of buildings are made of earth. Rammed earth walls are built 18 to 24 inches wide. That's two or more than three times as thick as conventional framed walls, which keeps the building cool in the summer and warm in the winter. Rammed earth homes are built with moist soil mixed with a small amount of cement into a form and ramming it until it's hard and only about 50% of its original volume. When finished, the rammed earth wall is essentially reconstituted sedimentary rock. Its strength rivals concrete. The resulting walls are fireproof, rotproof, termite-proof, and nearly soundproof. End of the quote. The dome shape has many advantages also, and is reputed to rebuff tornadoes and high winds, as the tornado simply goes up and over the dome as though it were a hill. I quote from the Troubled Times pages regarding Buckminster Fuller's geodesic domes from a book called Bucky Works. All domes share certain advantages, whether or not they are geodesic. Their compound curved shape is inherently strong, giving a self-supporting clear span with no columns. Field experience has shown that home-sized domes use about one-third less heating fuel than an equally well-insulated conventional home of the same floor area, built of the same materials. End of the quote. That concludes our broadcast. Thank you for being with us. Remember to carry love in your heart. It's the commodity of the future. As the Zetas say, love may have a blooming going into the shift, as it ought. Those with great love in their hearts responding to the realization that little else matters.
You have been listening to a Blog In Broadcasting service, a service to others' endeavor. Thank you very much, and good night.